The Utmost Island, Chapter 18. When dawn came, the land looked more wonderful than it had at their last fading glimpse of it at nightfall, and more wonderful still when the growing daylight sharpened its colors. But most wonderful of all was the sight which they themselves presented to certain eyes that were observing them. From the cover of the nearby wood, four members of the Wampanoag tribe, three young men and a young woman, were watching. Amazed, breathless, fascinated, they peered through the foliage and discovered Iceland. In one of the sagas, there is told the manner in which the Icelanders came ashore, but it was set down to be read by other Icelanders who knew their countrymen's ways so well that many things did not have to be said. We shall never know them now, except by guess. It does not reveal how the newcomers seemed to the unaccustomed, excited eyes back of the trees. During the night, says the saga, stating only such facts as their home folk might not know, the tide had ebbed and the ship was aground in the middle of the channel. But they were so eager to get ashore that they could not wait for high water to come and help them beach the ship. They jumped over the sides and ran to the bank. That gives a sympathetic notion of men who had been long at sea, who had left their homes and were now scrambling to find places for new ones. But the Wampanoags could not understand being long at sea, since they knew of no far-off ports across the horizon. And with limitless ground on which to pitch their tents, they could never have understood a man land-hungry enough to seize a little plot and call it his. It was fine weather, continues the saga. When they reached shore, they looked about. They saw that there was dew on the grass. They touched it with their fingers and tasted it, and it seemed that nothing had ever tasted as sweet to them as this dew. Thus, the saga describes these wandering farmers who were overjoyed to find such splendid grazing for their cows. But the Wampanoags had never seen a farmer, nor yet a cow. They were, in fact, unprepared, through centuries of habit, to believe anything but the wonderful and unworldly. This was no handicap to their thinking. It enabled them to find much more that was marvelous in their discovery than the Icelanders were finding in theirs. The Wampanoags could indulge in the luxury of astonishment without having it spoiled by fear. Theirs was by far more ancient, the nation of the two, tracing its ancestry through fox and beaver to the very beginning of things. They could not remember, nor had they ever heard of, a time when the world was different, so what could change it now? The only big fear is fear of change, and that did not exist. Anything that seemed new was only the old in disguise, holding neither peril nor discomfort, delightful to be examined and recognized. What they marveled at mostly, taken for granted, of course, by the saga, was that Icelanders have white skin. To men with copper-colored skin, or with brown or black for that matter, it always seemed, everywhere and invariably until they got used to it, that a man with white skin is dead. When copper-colored men, or brown or black, die, the blood and color leave them. So the inference was clear. The white men were the dead. That was nothing to be afraid of, however, for no wall of fear had been set up between dead and the living. The dead had no hostility. If anything, they felt friendly remembrance of pleasant times passed together. The armor and yellow hair of the strangers were a source of additional assurance. In the morning light, they shone. That had a special significance to the Wampanoags. Reasoning in terms of what they knew and believed, they decided that these pale, capering, shouting creatures must be the ancient dead, transformed into those spirits of light who daily bring the sunbeams from the sky. As they watched, they tried to make no noise, by move or breath, which might alarm their bright visitants and make them fly away. But when the Sea King joined the others, with Ingolf's ancient flashing helmet making him taller and more dazzling than any, the four Wampanoags could repress their excitement no longer and dashed back to tell the rest of the tribe the rapturous news. The saga does not tell us what was the first thing that was said there in a European tongue, nor whether it was said by a bounder, a freeman, or a thrall, though we who live there now wish it had been recorded. Did someone shout, "Mine! Mine!" as they scrambled to take possession across the wet, clinging sands of the channel? Or was it an exclamation of surprise and pleasure? Apparently little time was lost in rollicking after that first outburst. When the high water returned, says the saga, it set the ship afloat. They rowed along the river until it opened into a lake. There, they cast anchor, deeming it a safe place to keep the ship. Many salmon were in the water, the largest they'd ever seen, and the ground was so fertile that they knew they need not build barns to hold winter fodder for the cattle. They decided to stay there. The medieval chronicler, thus briefly recording their selection of a site for their new world, then states in a single tiny sentence their accomplishment of a vital, monumental deed. He says, they built their houses there. That is all, and we are left to surmise much. How it was done, the eager planning, the back-breaking weeks, and above all, what it meant to them to have homes at last. How much it must have meant is shown by the way Icelanders measured a house. It was their very own method and expressed their anxiety about the kind of life they would have in it. When it was all built, they paced off its length 3 times. If, in these successive measurements, it seemed to grow longer, their fortune while they lived in it would grow ever greater. Probably the reverse was true too, but the only records tell of houses whose length increased. They were a very hopeful people. No trace of those houses remains, so they were built of wood, though stone was to be had nearby. It was the custom in Iceland to build of wood, and they meant to keep their Iceland customs. If they fit the place, good. If not, the worse for the place. But the place had a mind of its own, or what was as good, a way of setting a man certain tasks which he must do if he wanted to live. The country they came from might claim their memories, but the country where they were claimed their work. There was always one more thing to do, at one particular instant, on one particular spot, on no account to be delayed, whereas the past remained where it was and when it was, changeless, patient, to be dealt with at one's leisure. Iceland had to wait upon present need, even if Iceland meant a little boy held captive who must somehow be rescued. Somehow is a desperate word. The Sea King had no time to make his plan. There were too many pressing things to be done, and he was expected to give orders for his companions to carry out, as if they'd made him folk king and host king too. Was there no one else who could take the command? There was little vanity in the question, and in the answer he gave himself, no. It was an honor, of course, that they should so defer to him, a reward for having found him dependable. But it was a trap, too, for his wishes must be less than theirs. That was hard for a religious man to bear, for Wish was one of the oldest gods, and the way you prayed to him was to tell him silently and fervently what you wanted. It was frustrating to have to do his wishing on everyone else's behalf but his own. Most distressing was his inability to confide. To no one could he say, "I must go back to Iceland for my son." He had wrought too well, had found them too perfect a haven. They would never even let him imperil it. Son or not, no one who knew where they were would be allowed to return to Iceland. He could not save Eric alone. He could not navigate a ship alone. In his first frenzy, when they stole his boy, he thought that he might, and imagined himself with one hand on the tiller and the other on the sail, disdaining sleep as he scudded before the wind toward Eric and vengeance. Now that it was actually to be done, such fancies were not enough. More than two hands were needed to fight that westward running current with oars as well as sail, and it would serve no end if he stepped ashore in Iceland, staggering like a drunken man for lack of sleep, to be slain before his son's eyes. He could not seek aid of anyone, and yet must. Who then? Who that was both someone and no one? He laughed as he asked himself that meaningless question, then realized that there was an answer. Tyrker. What made him think of Tyrker? That Tyrker was a thrall, perhaps, and a thrall was not really a man. It would be like both speaking and not speaking. Or it may have been the memory of Earl Hakon, hiding under the pigsty with the slave Kark. For there, too, the price of aid was offer of freedom, which he had in mind to promise Tyrker. Would Tyrker betray him? Kark betrayed Hakon. Did all slaves carry knives against their masters? That group of his own slaves, whispering by the roadside after the priest's talk, stopping and bowing when he came by. Why? They were well treated. Tyrker was well treated. Hard to understand unless you are a slave. His thrall always put him at a disadvantage when they were together. The mean, perfidious stratagem by which he had been captured came sharply back to memory whenever Tyrker looked at him. If only it had been done some other way, not by feigning interest in his little son. Here, for the first time, because he was thinking of making Tyrker an ally, he wondered for an instant, oh, for the merest brief fraction of an instant, whether there was any way at all of enslaving a man that could make his slavery less bitter. At once he reproved himself for such an impious thought, remembering that a slave must not receive any sympathy as if he were a man. Tyrker, he asked him suddenly, when next they were alone, do you think about your son? Yes, replied Tyrker, with no show of feeling. Would you like to see him again? Yes. If you were free, you could go where you wished. Would you like me to free you? Tyrker made no sound, but his lips formed a silent yes. Do you admit I have treated you well? Have given you good food and clothing? Have done everything you could ask for? Tyrker made no answer until his master added, except perhaps that I have not set you free? Then Tyrker answered, yes. Then you want your freedom, not to escape from me, but to see your son. He thought he had tricked Tyrker into revealing the truth. If he hesitated in answering, he should be mistrusted. Tyrker answered immediately, I am not free, and therefore I do not think like a free man. I think like a thrall. With that, he closed his lips tightly, refusing to make his meaning any clearer. That left the matter where it was, with Tyrker's master knowing no more of his motives than before he had questioned him. The Sea King did nothing further about it for a few days, not wanting Tyrker to become suspicious and start looking for the purpose back of it until he was ready that he should. Meanwhile, he concluded that his thrall was homesick, but not resentful. That was a mistake, but one that had to be made because he needed Tyrker and must not think of reasons for doing without him. His plan took fairly distinct form. He would suggest to Tyrker the price of his freedom might be some sort of expedition to Iceland. Only might be, not would be. And it must be referred to in a vague, roundabout way, so that if Tyrker repeated it to anyone, it could be cried down as the exaggeration of a thrall overly eager to be free. They would do nothing until the raid on the Orkneys was underway, which would be as soon as the men started thinking about women. At the nearest point to Iceland, he and Tyrker would make off in the ship's boat. Then a silent, unexpected landing by night, a stealthy approach to his homeland, a quick blow, and they would be off with Eric. After that, all he could see, with Tyrker going one way, and Eric and himself another, with all of Olaf's men and ships trying to find them. It was possible that Tyrker might put Olaf on the track, hoping for reward. Hakon and Kark again. No, he vowed it should not be like that. He would keep his part of the bargain, fairly and to the full, but if there were the least smell of treachery. Slowly, slowly, he reproved himself, feeling his anger rising over a wrong that had not been done. Until I take the first step, I need not lose my temper over the second and third. When next he contrived to be alone with Tyrker, he again found himself beginning with the very same subject that made him most uncomfortable. "Tell me about your son," he said. "What sort of a boy is he?" "You saw him." "I mean," said the Sea King, feeling the old embarrassment, "what does he like to do?" "To play at being like his father, the same as your son." "They are about the same age, aren't they?" "They are exactly the same age." The Sea King tried to get over his discomfiture by smiling as he said, "So are their fathers." As Tyrker did not return the smile, he pretended he had not meant to jest and continued seriously. "And both of us left them in the lands we came from. It is all the same, all of it." "Not all," said Tyrker. "Only that you are not free. But that," said the Sea King, with a sly inflection of which he felt ashamed, "can be made the same too." Now he waited, maintaining silence stubbornly. Tyrker would have to speak out. With one man wanting his freedom and another who could give it, there could be no fair dickering. "There is a price, I see," said Tyrker, with disconcerting directness. "I will pay it. What must I do to see my son again?" "Let us rather say," his master gently corrected him, "that we two have the same difficulty, which we might help each other to meet. I too would like to see my son. My problem is in fact greater than yours, for he is in Iceland." "Ah," cried Tyrker quickly, "do you want me to fetch him for you?" "No," replied the Sea King, sensing a faint flavor of contempt. "I would not ask any man to save my son. That is for me to do. The most I would ask is help." Tyrker was about to shout that he would give it, but his master gave him no chance, for that would make it too definite, too difficult to deny. "We are speaking of what is unlikely to happen," he said. "Surely we two would never leave the others." On that ill-concealed hint, he dropped the subject again and did not refer to it for a long time, though Tyrker hovered invitingly near. Before taking another step, he wanted to be sure that Tyrker was not repeating what had been said. He had not pledged him to secrecy, but silence would show he understood the need for it. When days passed, the absence of rumors assured him that Tyrker had kept his peace. But had the Sea King suspected the reason, he would have drawn his sword and cut his thrall's throat on the instant. Despising his master's indirectness, Tyrker understood all the hints and guessed beyond them. He was being offered his freedom to help rescue Eric. What freedom? In this unknown land in the Western Ocean? He spat his contempt for so mean a bribe, After what he had suffered, he would have nothing less than to be free everywhere in the world, the free father of a free son. And that only Olaf could give. And Olaf, too, asked for a price. "Bring them back," the priest had whispered as they were pushing the ship towards the water. "All of them. Olaf must have them all." Thralls, being bought and sold, had a keen sense of price and value. Tyrker preferred Olaf's offer. The Icelanders would be given into Olaf's hands, all of them. Slavery or the adder pit for every last one. "I shall see my son," he vowed, "but my master shall not see his. Amen." He crossed himself to make the vow a holy one. The moment of their next meeting was chosen by neither of them, but by this newfound land wherein they both were scheming. The Sea King, faced by one of the duties which had now become harassing to him, decided that the country must be explored before winter against possible enemies. He called the men together and said to them, "1/3 of you shall remain here to guard the houses and the women and children. The rest shall divide into two groups and explore in opposite directions, but go only so far as will let you return before dark, and let no man ever be alone." The men thought this final order strange, not sharing his sense of being watched, but they would not think of questioning his wisdom. The saga comments, "They followed his orders for several days," indicating that they followed their own whims soon after, to wherever the wild, natural beauty of the land beckoned and enticed. Those tired men, who had journeyed from so far away, must have found such magic in a sweet scent or a violet shadow that it seemed a gate to paradise which they could not forbear to enter. To be sure, they should have followed their captain's orders. That they did not very nearly brought a tragedy upon them. The blame lay in his own lessening fervor, which they were beginning to reflect. Half devotion to the gods was getting half protection in return. One evening, as they straggled back, the saga continues, they found that Tyrker was missing. They felt sad because they'd grown to like him. Each man blamed himself. Leif berated them angrily, bidding them follow him at once in search of this missing thrall. But they had scarcely set out when they saw Tyrker returning. They welcomed him warmly, but he seemed not to notice them, being greatly excited. When they asked him where he had been, he answered them in Turkish and pointed in the direction whence he had come. Leif seized him by the shoulders and shook him, and after a few moments he regained his wits and said, in the Norse tongue, "I thought I had returned to my country." "Why did you think that?" Leif asked him. "Because," he replied, "I found a vine with grapes growing on it." Early the next morning, he led them to where he said he had found the vine, and it was true. There were many such, covered with huge clusters of grapes and a bluish-purple color. Leif turned to his men and said, "Now we will name this land to which Thor has led us. Iceland was falsely named to keep Harald Fairhair away, though it produces much that is green. Greenland, too, was named falsely to lure my father's enemies, though it produces little but ice. But this land shall be truly named, since none shall know of its existence but the gods and ourselves, and its name shall tell what it really does produce. Let it be called Wineland." There was much enthusiasm over this. In fact, there was ever-growing approval of everything he did or said. He was firmly fixed in the leadership he was eager to abandon, as in a trap. Only Tyrker could rescue him from it, Tyrker whom he had so nearly lost. He hastened to make sure of Tyrker in the presence of all. "A man proves his right to be free," he said, as if he had always thought so, "by showing more spirit and cleverness than a thrall need have. Now I give my word, for all of you to witness, that I shall set Tyrker free." A pleased murmur began, which he cut short with the word "but," said with great emphasis, so that Tyrker would mark the condition he imposed. But it shall be in such time and place as will let the whole world know it has been done. That is, when we raid the Orkneys. A twofold cheer went up for that, sentimental because of Tyrker and hearty because of the Orkney women. The thrall looked as grateful and surprised as he could. When they had congratulated him and left, and he was alone with the Sea King, he vowed he would do anything on earth to merit such generosity. When the detailed plan for Eric's rescue was at last laid before him, he feigned amazement in its astuteness, giving no hint that he had long since guessed it and had a better plan of his own. His fervor was unstinted, eager, reckless. "I love Eric like my own Atil," he declared, kissing his master's hand. "I would try to save him in any case, free or not. I thank you for giving me the chance." "Hold your zeal in check," the Sea King had to caution him. "It may cause suspicion." Tyrker expressed humble thanks for this reprimand, promising to keep watch upon himself as relentlessly as upon an enemy. He swore secrecy and loyalty by all the gods of the Norsemen and by his own country's gods, too, and even invoked the strange gods of the Bulgarians that he had worshipped in his youth. The only divinity by whom he did not swear was Christ, because Christianity was his present true belief, on whose mystical help he counted to get the Icelanders' heads cut off. In his own hut that night, he felt dissatisfied with the trap he was setting. He would get the Sea King back to Iceland and into Olaf's hands right enough, but what of the others? If he failed to bring all of them, Theobrand might take it as a pretext to deny him his freedom. All through the night, he turned the problem inside out, and by morning, he had solved it. He went to his master with what sounded like an improvement of their plan, simple and obvious, and a much surer way to rescue Eric. Its only drawback was that the Sea King would have to tell the crew about it, and might fall a little in their esteem, through seeming to put his own desires before theirs. "That is easily mended," said Tyrker. "I will tell it." And that night he did. When they were all gathered about the fire, he suddenly stated it, making no attempt to lead up to it gradually, but as if he'd just thought of it. "Instead of raiding the Orkneys," he said, "why don't we return to Iceland and do our raiding there?" From the shocked silence with which this proposal was received, the Sea King feared it had done so much harm that there was no chance of their getting anywhere near Iceland. He was sorry he'd let it be said. But Tyrker was the better judge. He was also the better tactician. He waited patiently for the men to get over their first abhorrence of attacking their own land. Then, instead of trying to retract and laugh it off, as the Sea King was preparing to do, he vehemently set to work proving the idea was an excellent one. The fact that he was a little man, the shortest of them all by a head, helped them. He sprang to his feet and paced about in the firelight, gesticulating excitedly, looking like one of those gnomes in whom they all believed, who climbed out of holes in the earth and got inside a man's head by saying what was true. Atil the Great was a dwarf, and Tyrker was standing, while the rest remained seated, for once they looked up, and he looked down. "It is no longer your land," he cried. "Stop thinking that it is. You have not the least part of it now. It's in the hands of the renegades, all of it, every inch that you once owned. It is not peopled any longer by countrymen of yours. All the men in it, the women, the very babies and dogs, have become your enemies. Servants of Olaf, ready to help him track you down. You owe nothing to the land or the people in it, nothing except a revenge that will give the Skald something to make a new song about." "What a revenge I offer you! What could humble them more, these proud ones who never yet were raided? And Olaf, their king, their darling, their all, what could enrage him more? He himself is coming to Iceland. Perhaps he's already there. Olaf, the all-wise, the all-knowing. He is searching for us this moment, on every sea, in every land, everywhere but in his own threshold. We will make him the jest of the world, to be laughed at until he falls in a fit upon the ground and the foam pours out of his mouth and the divine right out of his ears. All were intent on Tyrker now, fascinated by his little figure that quivered passionately in the firelight and the two sparks in his black eyes. "And the prize is to be won," his voice rose enthusiastically. "They are beyond what has ever been gained in any raid, as the voyage you have made is beyond any voyage. Iceland, which never paid tribute to you while you were part of it, shall pay it to you now, who have become sons of Wineland. There will be gold to be taken from rogues that you know have it. Much of it was your own gold, which they have laid hands upon. You will know where to look for it. There will be slaves. Those men who have done you wrong can be seized and brought back here to serve you, especially the Christian priest, he who thought to have you cajoling him, bribing him, seeking his favor, shall have his hamstrings cut so that he has to crawl about your floors like a dog, and you will call him by a dog's name and throw him bones and slops to feed upon. Our Sea King will get his son, and his wife too if he wants her. You will all get women. There have been women taken before this in many a raid, but not such women as these. These will be those who denied themselves to you because they despised you, or because their families were saving them for some Christian toad of Olaf's. They would not be your wives in Iceland. They shall be your concubines in Wineland. For myself, I wish only to be worthy of my freedom, to know I shall have earned it by helping you, who have been as brothers to me." He paused. There was a short silence, and then such a ringing cheer burst forth as not even the Sea King had been given. The gathering broke up after that, the men talking excitedly of the new plan as they went to their various quarters. Tyrker was at peace with his soul. He would fulfill the conditions the priest had set. All that remained was to contrive how he would slip away from them when they landed in Iceland, and tell Theobrand they were there. The next morning, the Sea King awoke with a feeling of jubilation. Tyrker's plan had won everyone over. There were many swords now to help in the rescue of Eric. It was as good as done. He gave orders to provision the ship, which was a simple task in that bounteous region, and left his men to their own practiced knowledge of making sure it was seaworthy. Then at last he was free for a while to do what had been crying to be done since the night they came to anchor in the channel. What he wanted above all was to follow his old habit of walking alone within that nearby wood, bringing along no thought of people or things, so that he might sense the spirit of the place and find out what was watching him from those deep, cool shadows. He had never told his men of the eyes that he knew were following him, because there was no danger from the hidden watcher. He had a deep reason for knowing it was so. This had happened to him once before. When? Where? He could not recall it, however, he strove to probe the dark corners of his memory. Elusive though it was, and whatever it had been, it was familiar and associated not with peril, but with ecstasy. Toward the wood then he walked, with the growing light of morning to haunt his haunter. Or rather, he let the wood draw him. The nearer he came to it, the stronger grew the sense of familiarity until it almost sang. Then, suddenly, as he stepped at last inside the leafy enclosure, he recognized the delicious memory he had been pursuing. Freya. Every bit of green and brown bespoke her presence. Here was the very place for her to dwell, where surely she must, with all his old dreams about her like a garment. How well, how truly this forest and this moment would befit her, as aptly as did that far-off time and spot where he once thought he met her. Here was that same untouched solitude, the same tranquility, the same remoteness from everything but thought. That same sacred depth of nature that changes a forest or grove or valley into a temple. And oh, that same great silence, made more silent still by an occasional tiny rustle of leaves, like the rustle of a woman's dress. He saw the green moss that was her velvet cloak, and the blue and yellow flowers that were her eyes and hair. Of course she lived here now, as once she lived, for all the same reasons, in the meadow near his home. It was a strange fancy for a man to have twice, especially a man with the sad experience as a first mistake. Freya had turned into poor, pitiful Helga, a mockery of the dream that made him love her. But had he chanced upon her now, he would have clasped her again in his arms and kissed her again and called her Freya again. It was Freya and his own youth that were haunting him, hand in hand. Back, years back, they pulled him through this magic wood into which they had lured him, to an earlier day before he'd grown old, before he'd had a wife or son, before he was a sea king. The day in which he searched the meadow, whispering, "Freya, I love you," and had not yet happened upon the fatal secret called knowing better. He knew neither better nor worse now, for the spell of timelessness was on him. He knew nothing at all. He only believed. His lips formed the words, "Freya, I love you," without his having told them to do so. And as he thought he saw a shadowy figure flit just beyond the range of this sight, he said it again, of his own accord, "Freya, Freya, Freya, I love you." Then he heard a faint little rustling sound. It was not the leaves this time. It was a woman's dress. He knew it for what it was and turned towards it. At such a moment, Helga had stepped into his view, with her yellow hair looking like the beams Freya casts when she is the noonday sun. Now it was the Wampanoag girl whom he saw, with her black hair and bronze face, looking as Freya looks when she is the sunset turning into night. Feathers were her ornaments instead of flowers, and shells instead of silver, and her dress was the brown of earth and bark. One thing, though, was the same in the Wineland forest as in the Iceland meadow. Freya's eyes, though changed from blue to black, still looked with love upon the man she had been watching. The girl knew he had seen her, and stood her ground as he came towards her. When they were close together, the past fully enveloped him. All that had happened since that other time was undone and seemed never to have been. Then and now were one. His arms encircled her now as they had then. He kissed her now as then and called her Freya's names. Giver of love, most gently born of the gods, wearer of the flaming necklace, Freya. In that wood, on that shore, in those shadows, he could not have acted differently. All primeval places from which the gods have not yet truly been driven, in spirit and atmosphere alike. A true believer feels haunted in any one of them.